Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Michael Pollan. Farm to plate may be a common concept today, but it's one that Michael Pollan has been studying for the past 25 years. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and The Botany of Desire, which was later adapted into a PBS documentary. In The Omnivore's Dilemma, Pollan writes, "Eat food, not too much, mostly plants," going on to argue that the way we eat represents our most profound engagement with the natural world. In 2009, Pollan was named one of Newsweek's top 10 new thought leaders, and in 2010, he was listed as one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. From the 2008-2009 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Michael Pollan speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for that kind welcome. It's wonderful to be back here in Portland. A place where, you know, I mean, it's a good book town, a good food town, a place where I feel very comfortable. Although I have to say, in all the times I've been here, this might be the first time I've seen the sun. I didn't know you had one. I know it's a secret. You know, Portland, the Northwest generally, but Portland especially, is really one of the incubators of this new food economy that's rising all across the country. And this is a place I know, having been coming here talking about these issues over the last few years, that this was a place that got it really early and continues to lead the way in many ways. So I'm really delighted and flattered that so many of you would have turned out tonight. And are you're all here to hear the guy talk about food for an hour? Are you in the right place? Okay. Now, when you think about it, it is a little surprising that the Northwest would have would have such a deep understanding of food and farming, since it is generally assumed that to grow it, you need sun. But somehow you managed to grow plenty of outstanding food without it, an achievement on which I congratulate you. Now, thanks to Literary Arts, too, for putting on this event and inviting me up to Portland. And to Carrie for that wonderful introduction. It's January. Now, I come from the world of the media, as you know, and January has a particular meaning for those of us in publishing, whether newspaper or books or even in television. And that is, it's called, I don't know if you know this, it's called the new you season. And that's why every new diet book, every new self-help book is published in the month of January. It is the time for New Year's resolutions, new memberships at the gym, and new diets. And it's a particularly kind of schizophrenic time. If you turn on morning television, which I did the other morning, and you have ads kind of at war with one another. You have Taco Bell, trying to push their concept of the fourth meal of the day with their contribution to American culture. And then on the other hand, you have all these ads for Jenny Craig and weight loss formula. So you get a kind of sense of our madness around food, I think, particularly in the month of January. So it seemed to me that in honor of the new you season, I would talk today about diet. But try perhaps to do it in a slightly different way than you normally hear it discussed. My premise today is this. There are no healthy people without a healthy diet. That's not too controversial. But take it another step further. There is no healthy diet without a healthy agriculture. And that's the step I want to take. I want to expand our definition of health and what it means to eat in a healthy way. In the hopes of dispelling some of the really dysfunctional attitudes that we hold toward food in this country. You know, we've all heard about the French paradox, people who love food and eat all these supposedly lethal substances, foie gras and saturated fat washed down with lots of red wine, yet inexplicably to us, they're somewhat healthier than we are with our highly engineered low-fat diets. And we call that the French paradox. Well, I would submit there is an American paradox too, and it's not nearly as happy a one. And that is people who worry more about our dietary health than just about anyone on the planet, and nevertheless are the champs in type 2 diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and diet-related cancers. We have become a nation of, in the words of one doctor, orthorexics. Orthorexia is a new eating disorder recently diagnosed in Americans. It's an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. I think you'll agree. You know someone like that. Perhaps you know someone very well like that. So how did we get here? How did we come to develop this kind of obsessive concern with healthy eating and a scientific approach to food that doesn't seem to work very well? Well, as I looked at this question when I was doing research for In Defense of Food, I realized that a big part of our problem was the ideology we bring to the understanding of food. Now, an ideology is not, is a kind of unconscious way of understanding reality. Ideologies work best when we're not aware of them. And I think we're largely not aware of the underlying assumptions that govern our understanding of food and health. So let me see if I can kind of bring it out into the light of day a little. And you tell me if this, what I'm describing, these four assumptions of this ideology, which I call nutritionism, if they don't accurately reflect the common understanding and perhaps your own understanding of food and what it is. The first premise of nutritionism is that the key to understanding food is the nutrient. That foods are just kind of like delivery vehicles for these really important things called nutrients. And that a food is essentially the sum of its nutrient parts. That's the first idea. That's what you have to understand are the nutrients. The second premise follows from the first. And that is that because nutrients are invisible, I mean, who's ever seen a nutrient? Who's ever tasted a nutrient? They're therefore slightly mysterious, and like many unseen things, you need experts to help you mediate your relationship to them. It's a little bit like a religion. You know, the important entity with which you're trying to relate is invisible to you, does not talk to you, is you know, insensate. So therefore, you need a priesthood to mediate your relationship to the divine. Well, the nutrients are sort of like the divine, although they can also be like the devil, but I'll get to that in a second. Given if nutrients are the important thing, you just by accepting that premise, you have acknowledged that you don't know enough to figure out how to eat, nor does your mother. So you need experts, you need doctors, you need food pyramids, you need diet books, you need journalists to tell you how to do this thing that, you know, for most of history, people have managed quite well without that whole class of people. So that's premise number two, expert eating. The third premise might seem really uncontroversial, and that is that the whole point of eating is health. That when we eat, we are doing one of two things. We are either promoting our health or ruining our health. But that essentially is the spectrum on which this activity takes place. Now, if you read history or you travel a little bit, you realize, much to your surprise, that people have eaten for many other reasons. They eat for, pleasure. They eat for community. What happens when we break bread together, when we eat with our family or friends? That there's a very cultural thing going on there that isn't merely biological. They eat to express or to help form their identity. You know, we're the people who eat this food, and we're the people who don't eat that food. And if you have a teenager, you know how important eating choices are to the expression of identity. And we eat for spiritual reasons. I mean, what great religion doesn't have a ritual involving food? We eat to engage not only with other people, but to engage with nature. It's one of the ways we commune with nature, is through food. So there have been all these other meanings, purposes, functions of food that I would argue are at least as legitimate as the narrow concern with health. So that's premise number three. The fourth premise, and in this nutritionism, what do you need? Oh, sorry, we have an allergy issue. What's funny about that? There was gluten in those flowers, I think. I'm surprised they were real, aren't you? So the fourth premise of nutritionism, and this premise is typical, I think, of almost all ideologies, is nutritionism divides its world, the world, into good and evil. There are the good nutrients and there are the evil nutrients. And at any given moment in our dietary history, we are trying to drive some satanic nutrient out of the diet and install some blessed nutrient. Now, the satanic nutrient, what are some of the satanic nutrients today? Trans fats, fats in general, trans fats for sure. What else? Saturated fats. Refined carbohydrates, sugar, high fructose corn syrup. We've got that. We have a nice team of devils in our diet right now. And then on the other side, at any given moment, there are the blessed nutrients. Chocolate cake? No, you don't get it. I was thinking more like omega-3 fatty acids. That is the blessed nutrient. They are now micro-encapsulating fish oil and firing it into your bread and your yogurt. And it's appearing in all sorts of places that have never, you know, terrestrial foods are suddenly getting this surf component that they've never had before. Surf and turf are no longer distinct. What are some of the other blessed nutrients? We've got whole grains, antioxidants. That's a really good one. Whatever they are, they're really good. And we've had, of course, oat bran. Remember oat bran? That was a really good nutrient. Fiber in general, although it's in eclipse right now. Its reputation is declining. But this is how we organize our dietary lives. And we've been doing this for a long time. And the important thing to understand about the good and evil nutrient is that their identity is constantly shifting. And what may be on the good side of the ledger now ends up on the evil side at another time, and vice versa. And you go back 100 years to the kind of dietary fads of the turn of the last century, that moment when John Harvey Kellogg and Horace Fletcher and C.W. Post were the diet gurus, and they had that wonderful sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, where all the luminaries of that period came to, have their dietary lives changed and have, you know, yogurt enemas and all the good things that happened there. Very interestingly, they thought protein, which is pretty much a good nutrient today, was the evil nutrient. And that protein in your colon would breed noxious substances that would sicken you and lead to cancers and things. And that the blessed nutrient then was the carbohydrate. So the reason that Kellogg and Post invented cereal, breakfast cereal, was they were driving the satanic protein from the morning meal and installing the carbohydrate. And they succeeded, by and large. So it's important to understand that this is a long history in America. We have been trying to eat scientifically. In fact, the phrase scientific eating in America begins around the 1860s. You start finding it. But it's a very uncertain history because the identities of these good and evil nutrients keep changing. So those are the four premises of nutritionism. As I suggest, it's been around for a while, but it really reaches its flowering in our own time. And there is a modern history of nutritionism, of it taking over not only our minds, but the government and the food industry that really begins in the 70s. And I just want to walk you through a couple red-letter events in the history of nutritionism to help you see how pernicious it is and how there were certain decisions that led to its takeover. One you probably heard of, one you may not have. There was a very obscure, but I would submit important decision made by the Food and Drug Administration in 1973. And the 70s really are where this begins in the modern history of nutritionism. Since 1938, with the founding of the Food and Drug Administration, there had been a law on the books called the imitation rule. And if you were going to sell a food that was called, say, cream cheese, it had better have cream and cheese in it to warrant that name. There had been a history of adulteration of food in America that went back, and that's, you know, you read about that in Upton Sinclair with all the strange things that ended up in sausages. And so Americans were very concerned that people were going to pull one over on them with their foods. So we had the imitation rule, and it basically said, this is the FDA's language, it's not the legislative language, but the FDA's explanatory language. There are certain traditional foods that everyone knows, such as bread, milk, and cheese, and that when consumers buy these foods, they should get the foods they're expecting. And if a food resembles a standardized food but does not comply with the standard, that food must be labeled an imitation. Pretty reasonable idea. Not too controversial. But it was a real problem for the food industry. They really wanted to re-engineer a lot of these traditional foods. And they were assisted in this goal of overturning the imitation rule by the public health community. The American Heart Association, basically in the 70s, having settled on the idea that fat was the great dietary evil that explained the epidemic of heart disease in America, they were all for using food science to re-engineer the American food system, but the imitation rule stood in the way. The reason being, would you buy something called imitation cream cheese? I don't think so. Imitation was really the kiss of death in the market. So with those stars aligned, the industry and the public health establishment, the FDA very quietly, and this decision appears in the 38th paragraph of an article in the New York Times about changes in labeling, simply threw out this law. And those of you who are lawyers understand that an agency of the government cannot throw out a law of the Congress. But that is what happened. So it's still not legitimate to this day. And this opened the floodgates to all these new engineered products that we've been living with ever since 1973. Now we have the blessing of cream cheese with neither cream nor cheese in it. And a whole lot of other products like that. The next red letter day, I would argue, is in 1977. And that is when Senator George McGovern was chairing a Senate Select Committee on Nutrition. And he held a couple days of hearings about heart disease and the American diet and concluded based on those hearings that animal fats, saturated fats, were the big problem in the American diet. And his committee issued a set of dietary goals for the United States. That's what it was called. It's the first time that the government had endeavored to change everybody's diet, not just the diet of certain people, sick people, say, but everybody. And this set of dietary goals said things like this, and this was a signal line. One of the pieces of advice was these four words: eat less red meat. Everybody understood what that meant, whether you agreed with it or not, there it was. Well, those turned out to be four of the most controversial words ever promulgated by the U.S. government. The industry the grocery manufacturers, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association came down like a ton of bricks on the dietary goals and actually forced McGovern, who had a lot of cattle ranchers in his state, in South Dakota, to withdraw the dietary goals of the United States and renegotiate them with the industry. And so we began a tradition of completely compromised information from our government about food, and that all pronouncements about food must pass through the approval process of the big trade organizations. And they rewrote that line, just to give you an example, and the whole set of dietary goals changed in this direction, but those words, eat less red meat, were rewritten as follows. And in the transition from that one sentence to this other sentence, you see the rise, triumph indeed, of nutritionism. Eat less red meat becomes, choose meats that will reduce your saturated fat intake. Now, at one level, it's the same thing, but at another level, it's profoundly different. Consider first, we have taken a kind of a sentence in clear American English, something Orwell or E.B. White would be very happy with, eat less red meat, and we've turned it into something kind of hard to understand. Choose meats that will reduce your saturated fat intake. Many, many people back then certainly didn't know what saturated fat was. So this was really a helpful thing to make it really obscure. The second thing, though, is that we went from a message that essentially was eat less of something, red meat, to an affirmative message. Choose meats that, okay, eat more of something that will have less of the bad nutrient. Very different idea. And since then, and you look at any pronouncement from our government on food, you will never see an eat less message. Not even sugar. Okay? The government is simply not permitted to say eat less of anything. That's one thing. And the second thing. And the third thing is that we have enshrined the nutrient as the acceptable unit for a conversation about food. By the government, by industry, by all of us. We no longer talk about meat, we talk about saturated fat. And with that, nutritionism becomes the official ideology of the U.S. government and is taken over, in effect, by the industry. A few years later, National Academy of Sciences conducts a similar investigation into the links between cancer and diet. And even though the science they have, the only science they have, suggests some correlation between eating fruits and vegetables and some protective effect from cancer, they framed their recommendations in terms of things like beta carotene. Even though the evidence was about whole foods, they understood you had to talk about nutrients. It was so much more scientific and so much more confusing. I want to read you a brief passage where I talk in defense of food about what these changes in the 70s did to the American food industry, which I call the golden age of food science. Just a couple pages. In the years following the 1977 dietary goals and the 1982 National Academy of Sciences report on diet and cancer, the food industry, armed with its regulatory absolution, the imitation rule repeal, set about re-engineering thousands of popular food products to contain more of the nutrients that science and government had deemed the good ones and fewer of the bad. A golden age for food science dawned. Hyphens sprouted like dandelions in the supermarket aisles. Low fat, no cholesterol, high fiber. Ingredient labels on formerly two or three ingredient foods such as mayonnaise and bread and yogurt ballooned with lengthy lists of new additives, what in a more benighted age would have been called adulterants. The year of eating oat bran, also known as 1988. I can always judge the age of my audience. How many people remember the year of eating oat bran? Served as a kind of coming out party for the food scientist who succeeded in getting the material into nearly every processed food sold in America. Oat bran's moment on the dietary stage didn't last long, but the pattern now was set. And every few years since then, a new oat bran has taken its star turn under the marketing lights. Here come omega-3s. You would not think that common food animals could themselves be rejiggered to fit nutritionist fashion, but in fact some of them could be and were in response to the 77 and 82 guidelines, as animal scientists figured out how to breed leaner pigs and select for leaner beef. With widespread lipophobia taking hold of the human population, countless cattle lost their marbling, and lean pork was repositioned as the new white meat. Tasteless and tough as running shoes, perhaps. But now even a pork chop could compete with chicken as a way for eaters to reduce their saturated fat intake. In the years since then, egg producers figured out a clever way to redeem even the disreputable egg. By feeding flaxseed to hens, they could elevate levels of omega-3 fatty acids in the yolks. Aiming to do the same thing for pork and beef fat, the animal scientists are now at work genetically engineering omega-3 fatty acids into pigs and persuading cattle to lunch on flaxseed in the hope of introducing the blessed fish fat where it had never gone before into hot dogs and hamburgers. But these whole foods are the exceptions. The typical whole food has much more trouble competing under the rules of nutritionism, if only because something like a banana or an avocado can't quite as readily change its nutritional stripes. Though rest assured, the genetic engineers are hard at work on this problem. To date, at least, they can't put oat bran in a banana or omega-3s in a peach. So depending on the reigning nutritional orthodoxy, the avocado might either be a high-fat food to be assiduously avoided, old think, or a food high in monounsaturated fats to be embraced, new think. The fate in supermarket sales of each whole food rises and falls with every change in the nutritional weather, while the processed foods simply get reformulated and differently supplemented. That's why when the Atkins diet storm hit the food industry in 2003, bread and pasta got a quick redesign, dialing back the carbs, boosting the proteins, while poor, unreconstructed potatoes and carrots were left out in the carbohydrate cold. Now, a handful of lucky whole foods has recently gotten the good nutrient marketing treatment. The antioxidants in the pomegranate, a fruit formerly more trouble to eat than it was worth, I think you'll agree about that, now protect against cancer and, get this, erectile dysfunction. The people who brought you Pum Wonderful, the beautiful little, you know, jars of pomegranate juice, who were very clever about going out and doing the kind of research to get the health claims approved, have gone even further. And now they have, the research is in, apparently, although it hasn't been publicized, that pomegranate juice helps with erectile dysfunction. They got in a little hot water, though, with the animal rights people because they did their experiments on rabbits. Did you know they had this problem? Apparently they do, and pomegranate juice is the solution. A whole subcategory of nutritional science, funded by industry and remarkably reliable in its ability to find a health benefit in whatever food it has been commissioned to study, has sprung up to give a nutritionist sheen, an FDA-approved health claim, to all sorts of foods, including some not ordinarily thought of as healthy. The Mars Corporation recently endowed a chair in chocolate science at the University of California, my university, where research on the antioxidant properties of cacao is making steady breakthroughs, so it shouldn't be long before we see chocolate bars bearing FDA-approved health claims. And when we do, nutritionism will surely have entered its Baroque phase. Yet, as a general rule, it's a whole lot easier to slap a health claim on a box of sugary cereal than on a raw potato or a carrot, with the perverse result that the most healthful foods in the supermarket sit there quietly in the produce section, silent as stroke victims, while a few aisles over in cereal, the Cocoa Puffs and Lucky Charms are screaming their newfound whole grain goodness to the rafters. Watch out for those health claims. Check it out. Whole grain guaranteed. Look at this. It's all about vitamins. This is medicine. So anyway, that's the high water mark of nutritionism. Now, look, if this worked, if this way of thinking about food worked, I think we would put up with it. I think we should put up with it if it worked. But it doesn't. One of the most striking things about the rise of nutritionism is that it happens to coincide exactly with the rise of obesity and type 2 diabetes. Basically, it dates from about 1980. This is when we start re-engineering food as part of this, you know, low-fat campaign, and this is when we begin putting on weight. 12 pounds, on average, for every American has been gained since 1980. And we're eating about 300 more calories a day since then, per person. So nutritionism hasn't worked. I would submit, and I say actually in this book, that the ideology of nutritionism, let's see if I can find this quote, it's a little bit overstated, but what the Soviet Union was to the ideology of Marxism, the low-fat campaign is to the ideology of nutritionism. Its supreme test, and now we know, most abject failure. Now, why was it a failure? Well, there's two possible theories, and I'm not sure which one is right, and they may both be right. One is, though, that as soon as you divide the world into good and evil nutrients, you're essentially giving a free pass to the good nutrients. If this is a blessed nutrient and a little bit is good for you, then a lot of it must be really good for you. And this is, of course, what happened and is known in the industry as the Snackwells effect. You remember Snackwells? They're still there in the store. Now they're kind of cowering in a little shelf, you know. But in the 80s and 90s, they had entire aisles of the supermarket. They had as much space as dog and cat food. And it was this whole line of essentially junk food. Let's call it what it is, you know, crackers and cookies and sweets and things like that, that had been engineered not to have any fat. They were really pinnacles of food science. The problem was, there were two problems. One was to have your cookie or cracker taste like anything in the absence of fat, you had to add tons of salt and sugar to make up for the absence of fat. And there was also the phenomenon that people felt that since it was a no-fat food, it was kind of like water. You could just have as much of it as you wanted. And people gorged. We gorged on our low-fat and no-fat food. So that's one problem. But the second problem is the science on which nutritionism is based simply isn't very good. And this is, to me, one of the most eye-opening things about learning about nutrition science over the last couple of years. The harder you scratch and you look beneath the splashy articles on the front page of the newspaper saying this study, you know, women's health study, 46,000 women found that the low-fiber diet, in fact, did not change their risk of getting cancer, whatever it is. These studies that sound so big and authoritative, you look closely and they're pretty sketchy. There's a couple problems. I mean, and nutrition scientists will tell you this. It's very hard to study diet. It's not like studying a drug. There is no simple, you can't do a double-blind study of diet. As soon as you take something out of someone's diet, you have to replace it with something else. So you don't know if it's the absence of the thing you removed or the presence of the thing you substituted that has whatever the perceived effect is. You also have all these confounding factors. I mean, we don't just eat. We don't just eat single items. We eat things in relation to others. Take something like supplements. It's well established that people who take supplements are healthier than other people. But before you go out and buy supplements, you should also consider this scientific finding, which is that any time they've taken a supplement, whether it's vitamin E or beta-carotene or a whole raft of them that have been studied like drugs in double-blind studies, they're absolutely worthless. They don't do anything. Most of them. If you have a deficiency, a vitamin will help you. But basically, supplements don't work. So how could the supplement takers be so healthy? Well, there's something called confounding factors. If you take supplements, you probably are health conscious. And if you're health conscious, you probably get some exercise. You probably don't smoke. You probably eat more whole grains than average. And therefore, you are healthier. But it has nothing to do with the supplements. So you have that whole problem. The other problem you have with all this nutrition science is that how do you know what people are eating? It's almost impossible. There's few things, maybe sex, that people lie more about on surveys than what they eat. In fact, it's well known in the nutrition world that the data on which these large observational studies, like the nurses study, the women's health study, are off by a factor of 30%. That's pretty soft science, 30%. Now, there are a lot of efforts to correct for this, and they have various algorithms that make up for the fact that people understate their food consumption. But how do we know those are right? We don't. Now, I tried to take all these studies are based on something called the food frequency questionnaire. And you can go online and download a food frequency questionnaire and try to fill it out. And you'll stop believing most of these observational studies as soon as you do. I did one. And you're supposed to remember everything you ate for the last 3 months. Just think about it for a minute. Now, here's one question, okay? This one stumped me. Maybe it wouldn't stump you. Over the past 3 months, how often did you eat a half cup portion of okra, squash, or yams? And when you did, were they fried in stick margarine, tub margarine, butter, shortening, olive oil, canola, or non-stick spray? Got it? Write it on the back of your question form. I'd be interested to see. Now, not only do I not know what a half-cup portion of okra looks like exactly, I've never put my okra into a cup measure, but, you know, we eat about half of our meals are cooked by institutions of one kind or another. Do you have any idea what kind of fat they're using? I don't think so. So this is what all this is based on. And when I filled mine out, by the way, I tried to be completely honest. I put down every snack, everything I could think of, and it spit back the news that I was eating 1,100 calories a day. Now, you see, I'm a pretty big guy. I would vanish on 1,100 calories a day. I clearly forgot something, at least 30%. I'm guessing it was more like 50% in my case. So nutritional science should not earn our confidence in its pronouncements, not yet. It is, to be charitable, a very young science. It only really starts in the 1840s when Gustav Liebig nailed down the big three nutrients, the macronutrients, fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. So it hasn't been around that long. And I would submit that nutritional science today is approximately where surgery was in the year 1650. Very promising. But maybe I'll wait for the anesthetic and the disinfectant, the autoclave, you know, a few improvements. It's crazy to reorganize your life now based on such a science, I would argue. Foods are more than the sum of their nutrient parts. When we thought that beta-carotene was the important thing in carrots, and we took it out and we turned it into a supplement, it didn't work. In fact, certain populations, Finnish drinkers in particular, when they gave them beta-carotene, they got more cancer rather than less. That was kind of a head-scratcher. Foods are complex things. They're a wilderness. They're alive. They're changing. All the elements in them are in a synergistic relationship. Don't believe anyone who tells you they understand what is going on deep in the soul of a carrot. Someday, maybe. And then on the other end of the food chain, our bodies, human digestion and metabolism, this too is full of mystery. Did you know that you have as many neurons, brain cells, in your digestive tract as you have in your spinal column? What are they thinking? Why do you need brain cells in your stomach? Is this so you can think like Stephen Colbert with your gut? I don't know. This is another mystery to be unpacked. So Again, it's not yet something we should organize our lives around. So why does it persist? Why does this way of looking at food persist? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but I would just point to one or two. One is, it really is a great way to sell food. It began, of course, as a critique of the food industry, but the food industry is so clever in its marketing that it was able to by this marketing jiu-jitsu, turn it into a very positive thing. Because processed foods always win under nutritionism, because they can always be re-engineered. You can, whatever the fad is, if it's low carb, high protein, whatever, you can re-engineer what you're doing. So the industry loves nutritionism. It also fits very well with our agriculture, which is to say, huge monocultures of corn and soy, subsidized corn and soy, really cheap, fungible packets of starch, protein, and fat that can be engineered into any number of processed foods according to the scientific weather. So it's a nice fit with the food system we have. But let us go back to the beginning of nutritionism and remind ourselves why we started talking this way. We started talking this way because we were sick. There is a public health crisis related to food, and it was beginning even then with all the heart disease post-World War II. Nutritionism did arise to solve a real problem, and that problem is the elephant in the room. It's the problem of the Western diet. And we have understood for more than 100 years that the Western diet, which I will define, you know, it's commonly defined as lots of processed foods, lots of refined grains, lots of free sugars, refined oils, lots of meat, lots of calories, lots of everything except fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grain. This diet, we have known for a long time, reliably makes people sick. We knew this going back to the 1890s, 1910s, there was this generation of British medical workers working in the far reaches of the empire, working in health clinics, doctors, and they watched as traditional diets began giving way to what they called store food. Okay, processed food came in, refined white flour came in, and suddenly they began seeing ailments they hadn't seen. They began to see heart disease, other forms of cardiovascular disease. They began to see obesity, type 2 diabetes, and they said, we've never seen this before. There must be some connection. And this gave rise to the term the Western diseases for this complex of four, basically, you know, killers, which are now four of the top 10 killers in the West. They were not, and they still are not, in traditional societies. So this we've known for a long time, this very simple fact that we can stand on. What we haven't known, and this is what all the scientific debate is really about, is what in the Western diet is leading to the Western diseases. Is it the saturated fat? Is it the free sugars and refined carbohydrates? And that's what scientists argue about, and that's what they will argue about for many years to come. But as far as we're concerned, it doesn't change that main point, that people who eat the way we do predictably get this sequence of diseases. Now, the other thing we know that we can hang our hat on is that these traditional diets that predate the Western diet are incredibly diverse. The human animal does not have one ideal or necessary diet. These researchers found that there were Inuit in Greenland who lived on seal blubber and lichens and hardly anything else, and they were really healthy. They had no heart disease and no diabetes. There were Central American Indians who ate a diet largely of corn, whole grain corn, and beans, and they were very, very healthy and did not suffer from these problems. There were Maasai warriors, some of the healthiest people on earth, who lived on a diet of cattle blood and milk. They did not have heart disease and all these kind of problems. What this suggests is that the human animal is well adapted to a great many different diets. The Western diet, however, happens not to be one of them. What an achievement for a civilization. to come up with the one diet that reliably makes people sick. Now, it's funny, but it's also really sad. And we find ourselves at this fork in the road, I would argue, when it comes to food. We can surrender to the Western diet and essentially get used to it. And that seems to be the road we're on today. We're waiting for evolution to adapt us to it. And eventually, probably it will. But, I mean, because it does represent a change in our environment. And probably right now, natural selection is selecting for people who can endure this diet. It's not really a very practical way to go, though. For one reason, most of these diseases don't really occur until after our childbearing years. So natural selection will have trouble weeding this out. Although there are, you know, I mean, it is happening. I mean, people who become obese in their 20s or type 2 diabetes in their 20s presumably are not reproducing as much as people who can tolerate this diet. But this is not a very pretty scenario. 1 in 3 children born in the year 2000, according to the Centers for Disease Control, will get type 2 diabetes. That is a very harsh sentence. That means an 80% chance of heart disease. That means $14,000 a year in additional medical expense. And that means about 7 years off of the average lifespan. So it's very serious. But right now, our approach to it is simply to medicalize the problem, deal with it as a technological problem. And there's a lot of terrific research being done on diabetes and weight loss, but it's all about drugs, mechanisms. You know, we're going down the path of bariatric surgery and pills, stomach stapling, and essentially we're turning diabetes into a lifestyle, just another marketing niche. There are magazines now in your supermarket called Diabetic Living. There are ads on television selling you equipment to help you cope with diabetes. That's how big this market has become. And people are getting wealthy off of these chronic diseases. And this is essentially how we deal with problems, usually, in capitalist America. We figure out ways to turn them into really exciting new business opportunities. So that's one way to go, to become the Lipitor nation, to become a place where there are dialysis centers on every street corner in the inner city, right next to the check cashing store. That's the path we're on. Or we can change the way we eat, which I would argue is by far the more practical, the more economical, the more beautiful solution. Dennis Burkitt, one of this generation of doctors I mentioned, and he coined the term the Western diseases, he said, the only way we're going to reduce disease is to go backward to the diet and lifestyle of our ancestors. That sounds like a daunting prospect. Can we really turn back the clock? The challenge is, can we get off the Western diet without leaving Western civilization? I think that is the challenge. And my sense is that we can, that it is possible. And I'll get to what I think that means. But we're up against this problem, though, which is this. And this is what I ran into after I'd gone through all the science and the nutrition in trying to understand the simple question of how should I eat, is if we can't count on the scientists to tell us how to eat, who can we count on? It's not me. I'm not an expert. It's not... So I thought long and hard about, well, where might we find wisdom? And I thought back to the ancient past. How did people do it then? And, you know, I thought back to, as you often do when you're writing this kind of thing, to a somewhat fictional but plausible state of nature. And to the first time a band of early humans, who were omnivores, of course, and eating all different kinds of things, tasted a poisonous mushroom. Somebody picked up this mushroom and ate it and keeled over and died. There were no scientists, there were no doctors. What did the other people do? Well, they said to themselves, we better remember this. How can we remember this? What tools do we have to remember this? And someone said, hey, let's give it a really memorable name. Let's call it the death cap mushroom. It has death in it. That'll remind us it's not good to eat. And that's what they did. We have language, which is to say we have culture. And, you know, the prestige of science is such in our society today that we forget that there are other systems of knowledge that have really helped us negotiate our relationships to nature and even to our own bodies. And culture is one of those. So what I decided would be more interesting to do than to try to get the best science I could find was get the best cultural wisdom. And that even though we are talking about a biological process, that there is another kind of wisdom. And so I tried to come up with some rules for eating, a way to talk about how we should eat that's framed not in the vocabulary of science, but in the vocabulary of mothers and grandmothers, in the vocabulary of culture. Culture is really, when it comes to food, just a fancy word for your mom. Because wisdom about food is passed down through generations. But that chain of wisdom has been broken by nutritionism. My mother fed us stick margarine, Mazola, because she had bought in, she had had her confidence in butter destroyed by public health authorities, nutritionism, what she was hearing from the government. So we ate this stuff that turned out to have it didn't have saturated fat, that's supposedly lethal fat, but it had the demonstrably lethal fat called trans fats. So we traded in a possibly unhealthy fat for one that we know is very unhealthy. But she had had her confidence destroyed. She's back on butter now. But so how can you restore that chain, that broken chain? And so I started collecting kind of more everyday wisdom about food to see how that would avail. And I am still in the process of collecting cultural rules for eating. And I urge you, if you have any, you know, things your grandmother used to say or your grandfather or things you just kind of absorbed from your own ethnic tradition perhaps, to send them to me because I want to assemble them. Some are in this book, but I've come up with more and I want to put them in a pamphlet, something that we can, you know, give to doctors to give to patients. Doctors often ask me for this because they're looking for a better vocabulary, too, in which to talk to their patients about diet. But as I look for this kind of wisdom, it came down to seven words. Many of you probably know these seven words now because I published them on the cover of my book. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. That really kind of came, you know, that really said it all. And I was kind of alarmed when I realized I could reduce this thicket of nutritional confusion to seven words because I had promised 50,000 words to my publisher. But fortunately for me, it isn't so simple to eat food. You need a whole subset of rules to help you distinguish the food from the what I call edible food-like substances that increasingly are taking over the supermarket in our lives. So the first part of my cultural rules for eating really deal with making that distinction. How do you know when you go through the supermarket, where's the food and where are the edible food-like substances? Well, one rule I propose, and this goes directly to this cultural idea, is don't buy anything and don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. Imagine she's with you as you're rolling down the aisles and you pick up that box of Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes. And your imaginary great-grandmother pulls out one of those toothpaste-like plastic tubes and beholds this thing. What is it? How do you put it in your body exactly? And she reads the instructions. I'm not the instructions, I'm sorry, she reads the ingredients. I don't think there are instructions. And the ingredients, she understands, because she's kind of old world, that yogurt's a very simple food. It's really milk and a little bacteria. You have yogurt. But so what are these 15 other things on the ingredient list for Go-Gurt? What is the carrageenan and the xanthan gum and the red dye number 5 and the artificial flavorings? And that led to another rule, which is it's not food if it has more than 5 ingredients you don't recognize or that your fifth grader can't pronounce. It's not food if it has high fructose corn syrup. Now, that recommendation might sound kind of nutritionism-ish, because it's demonizing a particular nutrient. But that's sort of not the point. I'm not saying that high fructose corn syrup is any worse than sugar. What I'm saying is high fructose corn syrup is a novelty, and it's not something any home cook you know has probably ever cooked with. Do you know anyone with high fructose corn syrup in their pantry? And that might be another rule, which is don't buy any products that have ingredients that are not in your pantry. That would rule out a lot of stuff, depending on your pantry, of course. You may be a food scientist. I also, you know, offered some rules for navigating the supermarket. And one was that if you want to eat food and avoid edible food-like substances, shop the perimeter of the store. The reason for that is that the perishable foods, the food that needs to be restocked on a regular basis because it won't last that long, is always arrayed around the side so they have easy access to the coolers in the back or to the loading dock. And the imperishable food, the stuff that lasts forever, is all, you know, in the middle. And there, the food never dies. And the example of this that's really struck me, and I brought some. Let me know who wants this when I'm done. Are Twinkies. Now, in 2006, when I was on book tour for Omnivore's Dilemma, I bought a pack of Twinkies and used them as a prop. It's actually not this pack. That pack has gone to a museum. But, I got back from book tour and I put it on the shelf in my office. I have a little collection of corn-based items there. And every now and then when I was on the phone or distracted or stuck on a sentence, I would reach over and just give it a little squeeze. Well, I can report that 2.5 years later, those Twinkies are as soft and spongy as the day I bought them, which represents an incredible achievement of food science. I mean, they are nominally a cake. Now, why have those Twinkies not spoiled? Well, if you think about it scientifically or ecologically, you realize that, well, what does it mean to spoil? What it means to spoil, by and large, is that the other animals, the microbes, the fungi, the bacteria with which we compete for food and have since time immemorial are attacking food. That's why it goes bad. That's why it ferments. That's why it rots. Those microbes are apparently not interested in these Twinkies. I'm afraid to think that they know something we don't know, that there is not real nutrition there. So they leave the Twinkies alone. So in general, that leads to another rule. Don't eat any foods that won't eventually rot. Food should rot. There are a couple exceptions. Honey, you know, lasts forever. They found honey in the Pharaoh's tomb, apparently, and it was in pretty good shape. So those were some of my rules for how to avoid edible food-like substances. And simply by doing that, you will eliminate the worst elements from your diet. But I also learned that rules about eating aren't just about the content of our meals. It is about meals themselves, how we eat, the rules that govern our eating, the size of the portions. The amount you eat, we have what's called a unit bias as a species. If I put a plate of food in front of you and I say 2 Twinkies is the proper amount, that's how much you will eat, by and large. So the larger the plate, the more food people eat. There have been many experiments to prove this. We basically eat 30% more food if we're given endless portions than we would if we're given a small portion. There's a psychologist who set up a very interesting test at Cornell with a bunch of students where he brought them into a restaurant and he had these soup bowls that refilled from the bottom. And he put them in front of these students and they would keep eating, and they ate 30% more than people who didn't have the automatically refilling soup bowls. And the people who had the refilling soup bowls reported that it was really hearty soup. So portion size. And, you know, we talk about the French paradox, but the French paradox may well have to do as much not with what they eat, but how they eat. The fact that French plates are much smaller than ours. The fact that the French don't snack as much as we do. That they think it's an abomination to eat in your car. 20% of American meals are eaten in the car right now. So I have rules about that, too. One is, don't get your fuel at the same place your car does. That'll protect you from all sorts of things. And a way of eating, and if you can, don't eat alone. Eat with someone, and never eat in front of the television. I mean, think about how mindlessly you eat in front of the television. I had a son who was a very, very picky eater, and the only way I could get him to eat vegetables would be to give him a bowl of raw string beans or peas or broccoli. And if he was in front of the television, he would eat them. He didn't even know what he was doing. So there's a kind of mindlessness attached to that. So eat food at tables. Simple rule. And no, a desk is not a table. And I talk also about cooking. Food you cook is going to be much better than food that someone cooks for you, by and large. Cooking is one of the best predictors for a healthy diet. Because when you cook, you do not add high fructose corn syrup. You do not add lots of sugar or fat or salt. So I have a whole lot of rules like that. And I invite you, if you have some, I've set up an email address of foodrules@michaelpollan.com. Please send me your rules. One I got last night was, don't eat anything bigger than your head. I'm not sure it's a good one or not. You know, a melon? That's not so bad. It's not food if it came to you through the window of a car. And another one I kind of like is eat all the junk food you want as long as you cook it yourself. So in other words, if you can figure out how to squirt the cream into one of these cakes and bake the cake, be my guest. And if you think about something like French fries, you know, which are delicious, if you made it yourself, which I've done, you know, it's a mess and it's a lot of work. You've got to clean the potatoes and peel the potatoes and cut the potatoes and fry the potatoes and clean up the fat and what do you do with the fat? You would have it maybe once every month or two, which is probably about right for French fries. I mean, so much of our overeating has to do with what economists call the time cost of eating. That there's so we can have special occasion food every day because industry will make it for us so simply. So eat all the junk food you want. Just cook it yourself. Now, the book in which I put a lot of these rules, I called An Eater's Manifesto. And just in finishing up, I want to talk about why I think it's a manifesto, why I think there is a politics to what I've been describing to you. This hasn't been a very political talk, but subliminally, it's a very political talk. Because in inviting you to think about food in this way, to think about eating real whole foods, I think if everybody did that, if more of us did that, there would be an exodus from the supermarket and the fast food outlet. If everybody ate this way, seeking out real food, eating it at real meals, think about how much would change. Farmers could start growing real food again instead of raw materials for processed foods and fuel for our cars. It would expand the market for alternatives. So it would be a very good thing indeed, because the goals, what we want to do for our health, turns out to be exactly what we want to do with our agriculture. The missing link has now been established. It turns out that what is best for our health is best for our agriculture too, for the plants and the animals and the landscapes and the soil that we depend on. This idea was put forth a long time ago, you know, by Sir Albert Howard, the founder, really, of organic agriculture. He said, and there was very little science to support him back then, that the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal and man is one great subject. All those things are connected. Well, the science is now coming in on that. It's good science, and it suggests that how you treat the soil, how you treat the plants, how you raise the animals dramatically affects the nutritional quality of what you're producing. And one of the things that's been going on during the last 50, 60 years of industrial agriculture is that the nutritional quality of our food, and this is not me talking, this is the USDA's own numbers, the nutritional quality of our food has diminished by between 30-40%, going by what they regard as important nutrients. The varieties we choose, the source of fertility we use, the kinds of pesticides we use, when we pick it, how long we transport it, it's all connected to health. What does that mean? Well, what it means is your personal health is not bordered by your body. You're not a machine taking in either good or bad fuel. Your health is linked. Your health depends on the health of the whole food chain of which you are a part. Now, this expansion of your understanding of health extends to our families and our communities too. Where are you buying your food? Are you shopping at the farmer's market? How you eat, where you get your food, all these things matter just as much as what you're eating. The farmer's market contributes to the health of your community, to the local economy. We have 10 times more conversations at the farmer's market, a sociologist recently discovered, than we have in the supermarket. They become the new public square. So buying food there is contributing to that sort of health as well. Are we cooking real food and eating it with our families, with other people at actual meals? Shortening the food chain, taking back control of our food, is really the best thing we can do for our health, the health of our families, and the health of our communities. So health is not a question of nutrients good and bad, of magic bullets, supplements, or pills. That's the nutritionism approach. Rather, it consists of a set of relationships between our bodies and the plants and animals we depend on. Food is not just a thing or a product. Food is itself a relationship. Then not a pile of nutrients. It's a relationship between species in a food chain. Wendell Berry, I just want to leave you with two short quotes. One from Wendell Berry, who's a hero of mine and really began this conversation 30 years ago. He wrote then, "We must never forget that our land passes in and out of our bodies, just as our bodies pass in and out of our land. That as we and our land are part of one another, so all who are living as neighbors here, human and plant and animal, are part of one another and so cannot possibly flourish alone." And one last quote that I just got off of a bag of whole wheat flour I bought from Thomas Merton. And I thought this was a nice quote that gets at this relationship idea. And then I will turn to your questions. "From the moment you put a piece of bread in your mouth, you are part of the world. Who grew the wheat? Who made the bread? Where did it come from? You are in a relationship with all who brought it to the table. We are least separate and most in common when we eat and drink." Thank you very much. Thank you so much. I have a big stack of questions from you. Thank you. I will read all of these eventually. So let me find, where did I eat in Portland? You already know. I ate at Higgins, and I had a wonderful meal. With a name like Pollen, were you fated to study plants? Yes, there's a name for these names. You know, they're called career naturals, and I definitely have one of them. Well, here's a hard one. If it was in your power to eradicate childhood obesity, what would you do? Well, I think you have some idea, but let's say I were the Secretary of Agriculture and I wanted to eradicate childhood obesity. I think the first thing I would do is take a good, hard look at the school lunch program, which I hope that the Obama administration is going to take a look at. But, you know, this feeds everyone. You know, people talk about the elitism of the food movement and the fact that organic food only reaches the top part of the socioeconomic ladder. But the school lunch program reaches everybody. And if we can reform that, we can extend the blessings of good, sustainable food to everybody. Right now, the school lunch program, which is administered by the Department of Agriculture, which in itself I think is a problem, treats our children as a disposal for surplus agricultural commodities. What goes down that chute is simply what agribusiness has too much of. So there is lots of cheese, and there is lots of really third-rate hamburger meat. It's whatever they've got, milk, and tons of milk, whatever they have too much of. Now, that's a very interesting way to think about it. There's another way to think about it, which is, what would it be good for our children to eat, and let's buy that food and give it to them. Why don't we... I know, it sounds radical. But right now, the nutrition programs, and this goes for food stamps and WIC as well, are really operated in the interests of the food industry, not in the interest of their recipients. And that's the biggest change, I think, that you need to make. And the new Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, one of the most hopeful things he said in his today in his initial remarks before the Senate, but also when he was nominated by President-elect Obama, was that he, and people may have missed this because it sounds so kind of obvious, he said, we want to put nutrition back at the center of our nutrition programs. And it was like, well, duh, but it's not there now. And he understands that it's not there now, and it needs to be there. And if he can make nutrition what these programs lead with, I think that that would be incredibly helpful. To give you some examples, I mean, yes, there's all this free commodity food that's dumped on our children, but there are rules for minimum number of calories in school lunch, and there are no rules for maximum number of calories. So I know I've met school lunch ladies who are trying to cook really healthy food, and they get dinged for not having enough calories in the meal. And so that's how you end up feeding children tater tots and chicken nuggets. Get your calorie number up. That's how you're getting judged. Make no mistake, we are now teaching children how to become fast food consumers. We're teaching them how to eat chicken nuggets and tater tots in 10 minutes, right? That's how much time we give them for lunch also. We could be teaching them how to eat in a different way. Because to the extent that our food problem is, as I've suggested, a cultural problem, kids also need to learn how to cook. They need to learn how to garden. And so I really think that, you know, people like Alice Waters have it right, and that you need to teach all these things, how to eat at a meal with other people, how to grow food and how to cook it. And it would take, it's estimated, $1 a day per student to make a school lunch program that could actually have real fresh food. I think it should be part of the economic stimulus, because right now we don't have the kitchens to cook it in. You know, when you went to school, they still had pots and stoves, and they actually made the sloppy joe, you know. I don't know if you realize now, but it's simply reheated, microwaved food right now. It's all processed. So real food back in the schools, it would be a great economic stimulus. It would drive local food economies and has enormous potential to help with obesity. And that money you'd be spending, that dollar a day, you will save on healthcare costs. I guarantee it. Thank you. Oh, I got some rules. Thank you. Don't drink bad wine. Thank you. What are you doing to prepare for the coming climate disruption? Well, I've planted a garden. I think it's one of the most important things we can do to prepare for the coming climate disruption or lifestyle disruption. I really think that home gardening, planting victory gardens, and the reason you heard in the introduction that I've urged the new administration, the new president, to plant a victory garden in the White House. And we've had them before, you know. Eleanor Roosevelt had one in 1943. She planted it over the objections of the Department of Agriculture. They said, there's no good spot here on the White House lawn. I don't know what they thought. Not enough sun? I don't know. But if they just took 5 acres of that and started growing food, when Eleanor Roosevelt did it, and Woodrow Wilson did it too, there were sheep on the White House lawn during his administration. During World War II, by the end of the war, there were 20 million victory gardens that people had ripped out lawns and planted, and it was supplying 40% of the produce in this country. Significant contribution. Our lawns are one of the great wastes. And if you plant a victory garden, you're sequestering carbon, you're reducing your carbon footprint, you're getting exercise without driving to the gym. So it has so many effects. But I think the most important effect, and I've written about this a little bit, is the mental effect. One of our challenges in dealing with one of the reasons climate change seems so insurmountable as a problem is that we are addicted to cheap energy in our minds as well as in our lives, and that we don't do very much for ourselves. We're very good at what we do at work, and everything else we farm out to somebody else. And cheap energy allows us to do this. We have other people entertain us. We have other people feed us. We have other people clothe us. And one of the things that happens, and so that the prospect of living with less cheap energy seems just absolutely daunting. But as soon as you start gardening, you realize that you can use your body in support of your body in a way that's incredibly gratifying, very, very empowering. So I think that there's a psychological and, if you will, even spiritual benefit to growing some of your own food, if you can, if you have the space for it. Let's see. What is the single most important thing we can do as individuals to change the way food is produced? Well, that's really easy. Vote with your fork. Make food choices consciously. Pay the extra money if you can afford it to buy the grass-fed beef, to buy the food at the farmer's market, to join the CSA. All those things are really powerful votes. And you don't have to wait for Tom Vilsack to, get off the dime. You can. And one of the wonderful things about this movement and this problem compared to so many other problems, we don't have to wait for anybody else to start the change. I find that incredibly empowering. Why do you think America does not have deeply rooted traditions surrounding food? I think that's a really good question. And I'm not sure of the answer. I have a couple theories. One is that we are a very diverse people. There was no, single ethnic group that dominated and said, this is how you're going to eat. To the extent that there was one, it happened to be one with a crappy food culture called, excuse me, the English. But we didn't, I think one of the reasons, and we rejected a lot of immigrant traditions, one of the reasons that scientific eating became the watchword in the 1860s was people were very uncomfortable with immigrant eating, all these messy stews. What's in there? And it was part of our acculturating of these immigrant groups by the Anglo-American tradition that we said science would guide us instead of your messy stews. And so I think that that's part of it. It was definitely the Anglo-American tradition, which was all about, chunk of animal protein, vegetables, starch, was rejecting a lot of other things. So I think it has to do with our immigrant experience and how we dealt with it. What's your next book about? Beats me, I don't know. Where does exercise or lack thereof fit into the rise of poor health? Well, I haven't talked about it, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's a really important part of this. In Cuba, we worry about sugar and everything. In Cuba, the cane workers eat 6,000 calories of sugar a day, and they're not unhealthy, okay? So if you are getting enough exercise, you have a whole lot more latitude in what you eat. And a big part of our problem is just how sedentary our lives are, and that we don't use our bodies in support of our bodies. That's always, and those Maasai warriors too, who were eating all that cattle blood and milk and meat, that they were also getting a huge amount of exercise. So it's very, very important. However, when the food industry tells you that that's the cause of obesity, you need to look at the facts. Because in fact, since 1980, we are not more sedentary than we were then. In fact, we've had exercise fads, as you know. Lots of people have joined gyms since then and exercise since then that weren't before. The really notable change is the 300 extra calories. So the industry is wrong when they point at exercise. So my evaluation, there are a lot of questions here. What do I think about President Obama and the hopes for him bringing about change? And maybe I'll talk about that for a minute and leave it there. I'm hopeful, but not overly hopeful, that Obama will bring about change in this area. He indicated during the campaign on several occasions that he has a pretty clear understanding of the issues. This open letter to the next president that I published in the Times, Farmer in Chief, he actually gave an interview where he summarized my conclusions in about a paragraph and spoke in an approving way of the ideas in that piece, and particularly the way I had tried to draw connections between our agriculture and climate change, our agriculture and our public health crisis. Because my premise is you can't deal with the issues he's determined to deal with, the healthcare crisis, climate change, energy independence, without dealing with the food system, because it's 20% of the energy we use, it's a third of the greenhouse gases, and it's a huge part of the public health spending. So you need to drive through food on your way to solving all those problems. But agribusiness is one of the best organized lobbies on Capitol Hill. It will take a heroic effort. And my sense is that he does not feel there is yet enough public support for this change. And that's where our job comes in. And this applies to any issue you care about. You cannot assume just because you elected somebody that agrees with you that he will then do what you'd like to see him do. He needs a very strong wind at his back. He needs us pressuring him all along the way. And he said this to someone I know who was cooking for him recently, since the election, and was bringing up these issues. And he said, and I quote, "Show me the movement. Show me the movement." He is a community organizer. He wants to feel that pressure at his back. And that's usually how it works, and we forget that. There's a story told about President Clinton in 1993 after his budget negotiations, that momentous budget, where, you know, he kind of caved to the bond market, basically. Instead of, you know, following the advice he was getting from Robert Reich, he went with Robert Rubin's advice. And there's some good things in that budget, but by and large, it was a very Wall Street-friendly budget. And he ran into Bernie Sanders, about as far to his left as anybody in Congress, and shortly after that negotiation. And he said to Sanders, he started berating him. He says, "Why weren't you screaming at me? I needed you to scream at me so I could bring you something back from that negotiation." So we need to start screaming. We need to create a movement. This movement's very young, but it's gaining power, and not just on the West Coast. It started here, but it's everywhere now. There are audiences like this all across the country who care passionately about this issue and understand its importance. So, so let's show them the movement. Thanks a lot.
That was Michael Pollan speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2009.
Thank you.
This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community, without whom the show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.